From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. The federal farm bill working its way through Congress could dramatically reduce free school meals. Those meals offer significant help for the nearly 20% of Georgia households with children. The Food Research and Action Center say struggle to afford quality food. So many students in Macon qualify for the program that free breakfast and lunch are available to all. District-wide. Samantha Max reports on health for the Macon Telegraph and has been following the story, and she joins us now from Macon. Samantha, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
So you've been eating lunch with students around Macon over the last several weeks. Talk to some kindergartners who gave you a sense of what lunchtime is like inside of a Bibb County school.
Want to sit with us?
You can sit right here, Joy.
So, tell me, what are you guys eating today for lunch? Let's see.
Peanut butter jelly.
Peanut butter jelly? Do you guys get PB&J pretty often?
So what was the answer, Samantha? Do they?
Yeah, all the kids I was sitting with about half a dozen of them, and they were all eating peanut butter and jelly, and they said they have that pretty much every day. So basically, Bibb County Schools, they offer, you know, fresh, hot-cooked meals every day, but they also offer PB&J every day just as a supplement in case anyone doesn't like the main meal, and it's pretty popular.
So all students in the Bibb County school system are qualified for free lunch. Well, how do they afford it?
The way that it works, there's a federal program that in school districts where 40% or more of the kids qualify for free or reduced meals, basically, the district offers everyone free lunch, so it's really just a grant program through the federal government.
How much does the county spend on each student's nutrition?
So they get $1.82 for each lunch, 80 cents for breakfast, and a little bit less than that even for snacks. So it's not that much to work with,
no.
But they work with a lot of vendors and basically, before they think about anything else, the first thing when they're deciding on what vendor to go with is how they're going to fit it into this very small price pocket.
Now, you spoke with Tamichael Sharp. She's Executive Director of Nutrition for the Bibb County School District, about how school lunches come together.
We have to ensure that the items that we put on the menu are limited in the amount of sodium, fat, and some of the other nutrients that we are required to assess each item for. Then we have to put them together as a menu.
Well, that has to be some pressure, meeting all those requirements. Earlier this month, you reported that a version of the federal farm bill proposes restrictions that could slash funding for Bibb County's free meal program. What would that bill do if it passed?
Yeah, so the U.S. farm bill, which is supposed to actually pass by the end of this week. A version was proposed through the House that actually passed that would restrict SNAP requirements. So some of the changes would be that anyone who gets those SNAP benefits would have to have proof of employment. And one of the ways that Bibb County Schools actually qualifies for the program that provides these free meals is that so many of the parents are on SNAP. And estimates from the Congressional Budget Office and different parties that have looked into it have basically found that if these changes to SNAP happen, then a lot of adults with school-age children are going to lose their SNAP benefits. And the fewer people in the district that have SNAP benefits, the less likely they will be to meet that 40% that would get them the eligibility for the federal program. So then they would have to go back to an application-based program. And Ms. Sharp told me that it's nearly impossible to get 100% of families to apply for free or reduced meals. So a lot of kids would just end up falling through the cracks if they don't apply or if they don't qualify, but their parents aren't sending them to school with the money that they need to buy lunch.
Well, there is a good body of research on what happens to the brain when people go hungry. Again, Tamichael Sharp on how essential breakfast is to Bibb County students.
The breakfast program is critical to helping to provide the nutrients to start the brain cells and the body working again in the morning before they get to start trying to learn. And all they can think about is, I'm kind of hungry.
What do we know, Samantha, about the relationship between adequate nourishment and being able to succeed at school?
I mean, if you just think about how you are when you're hungry, you know, that's the first thing that's on your mind. And it's very difficult for these kids to concentrate. They're often more irritable. And Ms. Sharp was telling me that since they have introduced this breakfast program, their nurses' visits in the morning have gone down. Kids are engaging a lot more in the classroom because they have that energy they need to, you know, really be active in the classroom and not just be thinking about, I'm so hungry.
Well, the federal farm bill has a number of different sides arguing for and against. Has this discussion about free meals and the SNAP benefits made it into the forefront?
You know, it's hard to say. I think that people are really thinking a lot about SNAP benefits, but I don't know actually how widely known this community eligibility provision program is, which allows for all these schools to get free meals. It's a fairly new program. I think it started just a few years ago, but it could really be deeply impacted depending on what version of the bill passes. The Senate version did not include the changes to SNAP benefits. However, now the House and the Senate are kind of working together to figure out what the final version of the bill may be. And it's actually looking like they might not even meet the September 30th deadline. Because they're so caught up in this argument over the SNAP benefits.
Samantha Max, she covers health for the Macon Telegraph, also a reporter for AmeriCorps member. Her reporting is supported by the News Collab at Arizona State University. Samantha, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Augusta may be best known for the Masters Golf Tournament, but this Georgia city has more than one claim to fame. The Godfather of Soul grew up in Augusta.
Watch me! Watch me! I got it.
That is, of course, James Brown. More recently, the city has made a name for itself as a national hub for cybersecurity. Sharon Collins took her GPB series Hometown Georgia to Augusta to learn more about the city, and she's with us in the studio. Good morning.
Good morning. I don't know how you do this early thing every single day.
You producers, you people who make documentaries, this is a late night game.
Yeah.
Well, Sharon, for listeners who may not be familiar, what is the premise of Hometown Georgia?
Well, I created a show without a host and without a narrator. So I try to find a very diverse group of people and let them, through talking about what they do for a living and talking about how much they love their town, give you a feel for what it's like to live in that community. It's like putting together puzzle pieces, trust me.
Yeah, and an insider's view, it sounds like.
It is.
Well, you've been all over the state with Hometown Georgia, St. Mary's, Metter, Dahlonega, Blue Ridge. What was it that drew you to Augusta?
Because all anybody ever talks about is the Masters. And I thought, well, there's got to be more than that. And there is a great deal more. I mean, Augusta is in Georgia and in South Carolina.
Right across the river.
Yeah. And they call the part that's in South Carolina North Augusta. It's very confusing when you're driving around.
We mentioned singer James Brown was one of Augusta's own. And when you went there, you sat down with someone who knew him very well. Here's Deanna Brown Thomas remembering her father.
How he talked to the masses after MLK passed away to calm everybody down. How he came right here to Augusta, Georgia, did the same thing after President Johnson had him on television to talk to the nation. He came to Augusta. He didn't forget about home. He came back home, drove up and down Broad Street. Walked up and down Broad Street talking to people, encouraging them to continue the nonviolence.
Well, Deanna Brown Thomas remembering her father, James Brown. Deanna founded the James Brown Academy of Music Pupils in her father's memory. So what do you hear from people there about his influence on the music and the life in Augusta?
Well, Augusta has a sign that says, keep Augusta funky, because obviously that is James Brown. And you know, Deanna talks, as you heard, about he was very important and well-regarded in Augusta. She learned a lot from him by traveling worldwide doing his hair, because she would hear him do business. He was a very, very shrewd businessman. And gave back a lot to Augusta. And you find these connections. He performed and was friends with another entertainer, Flo Carter. She's the reason I mean, all these people you get to know.
She's a gospel singer, Flo Carter?
Gospel, but she also does some rockabilly stuff. She was up on stage dancing circles around anything I could do. And I get B12 shots now because of her. She's 89. And I said, what vitamins do you take? And she said, honey, I just get a B12 shot every 3 weeks.
Well, clearly you're giving people more than just a television show. Some great advice there. Augusta is now home to the U.S. Army Cyber Center of Excellence. Now, Michael Schaffer, who's Augusta University's Executive VP for Economic Development, spoke with you about the scale of that operation.
So think about that. $2.3 billion investment in this state. Every day, the men and women that are out at Fort Gordon are protecting you and me, all of our families, not just in Georgia, but across this country.
Wow, $2.3 billion from the federal government. Now, the state of Georgia is also investing $100 million more in this center. How is this going to change life in Augusta and in Georgia?
Well, as Michael said, there's a room for people of older ages, but this is a young person's game.
Yeah.
So you will see an influx of younger people, professionals, real tech types, and they will probably want a smaller footprint. They won't want the great big mansions of Augusta. They'll bike to work more than likely. So it will change the look and the feel of the downtown area in all likeliness. You know, I mean, when you get that many people coming in.
Could be as many as 4,000 people, it looks like.
Absolutely.
Right. Well, that's the thing, Sharon. You get to see so many towns across the state. Part of their tradition, exploring their tradition, like James Brown, you know, as the godfather of soul coming from there. And then what's going on that's new? That must be a really interesting perspective to see this shifting state. What's your impression taking that away?
You know, I make all these friends and I learn. I mean, it is a real education there. When you get outside of the metro area, there are a lot of things happening that we just don't know about, like the cyber center. For example, they're rebuilding Capricorn Studios in Macon. Who knew? You have to almost leave the town. And I'll tell you what, at least two or three people in every single town I visit say to me, how do you live in Atlanta? How do you deal with the traffic? And this morning I wondered, how?
You came in with the rest of us today.
Yeah.
Sharon Collins, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
So where are you going to next? Is it?
Columbus.
Columbus next week. Host of GPB's Hometown Georgia. You can enjoy past episodes and future at gpb.org. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Senator Susan Collins of Maine is considered one of few swing votes in the confirmation of federal judge Brett Kavanaugh to the Supreme Court. The Republican senator was uncommitted even before sexual assault allegations against Kavanaugh surfaced. Pressure from both sides is ratcheting up on Collins. Her office has been deluged with calls, threats, protests, and targeted by a crowdsourcing campaign to unseat her if she votes for Kavanaugh, who pro-choice groups predict will tip the court balance against Roe v. Wade. For the past 5 years, Collins ranked as the most bipartisan U.S. senator, making her the choice for the annual Constitutionally Speaking event in Manchester, New Hampshire. I spoke with her there last Friday on the subject of civility, cooperation, and compromise in our constitutional republic on the very day when those democratic norms felt in short supply. I asked her how life on the Hill has changed since she started as a congressional page back in the Watergate era.
In my time in the Senate, the level of polarization and sheer ugliness and lack of civil discourse has been unprecedented in the last few years. And I think it has a number of causes. It used to be when we would have very vigorous debates on the issues, and we always did, that people's motives weren't questioned. It wasn't assumed that there weren't charges that they were bought by somebody or some group. And what we've seen is the rise of these outside, highly ideological groups that demand 100% compliance with 100% of their views 100% of the time. And woe to you if you deviate, much less try to find a middle path forward.
So what about the party role here in pushing towards one particular ideology so that somebody says, no matter what the president says, I'm going to vote for him. No matter what the president says, I'm going to vote against his nominee.
Well, the party role for some people is very strong. For some people, it's less strong. I am a New England Republican. That is a very different breed from some of my colleagues from the Deep South, for example. I could never, ever be elected in Alabama to take a state. You notice I stayed away from Georgia in that example. And actually, I love Johnny Isaacson, who's a great senator. But in my state, independents control who gets elected. Do I care what the Republican Party thinks? Of course I care. But it does not control my vote.
Judge Kavanaugh is, many people suspect that he will overturn Roe v. Wade, and I want to talk to you about that. Based on the threats that you're getting, does that influence your decision? In other words, is that the exact wrong way to go about it?
It is exactly the wrong way to go about it. I welcome input from people who have different views from mine or who agree with me, or if I'm undecided or trying to influence my decision making. I think that's how you get to good decisions. But threats are the worst way to approach me. An example is this crowdfunding effort that several people are involved in that has raised $1.3 million. And in what I view as a quid pro quo, I mean, I really wonder whether it violates the bribery statutes. And that sure sounds like a quid pro quo to me. I do want to absolutely denounce the threats that have been made against Dr. Ford and also Judge Kavanaugh's wife. There's just no place for this in our society, and we've got to start speaking up and being united in condemning such behavior.
What will you be looking for, listening for, searching for in body language, in manner, in the way of speaking to tell, because, you know, that was one of the things that Dr. Ford's lawyer said, that this could easily devolve into a he said, she said situation. We know from Clarence Thomas and Anita Hill, both of them pilloried in front of the press. What will you be looking for in that hearing?
Well, first let me say that the Clarence Thomas, Anita Hill questioning by the Senate was a disgrace. We've got to avoid that kind of atmosphere. And I talked to a judge I knew. I talked to a state trooper, a prosecutor, an FBI agent recently about how do you assess credibility? Because that's hard. But ultimately, that's the job that we're going to have to do in this case. And I think you look at detail, you look at what you know about the person, their background, is there a pattern, questions like that. But it's why I feel so strongly about seeing both of them as opposed to just reading about the allegations. I think you get a much better sense if you hear the person.
You've made it very clear that you do not, as a woman senator, make judgments based on your gender. However, there are so many people have asked, like, what is your depth of commitment to important women's issues? What would it take for you as a woman to protect women and vote against Judge Kavanaugh? So I will reframe that question as what will it take for you to vote no or yes on him?
Well, I'm not going to answer that question.
I had to try.
I've answered every other question, but I'm not going to answer that one. But I do want to answer the question about women senators. Women senators do have, or have had, a special bond. And we get together for dinner about once a month. I remember a few years ago, one of my older male colleagues saying, "I hear you had another one of those dinners last night." And I said, "Yes." I was riding over on the subway with him for a vote. And he says, "Well, what do you talk about?" And I just smiled sweetly and I said, "We planned the coup." And
so I think it's appropriate to end civility and compromise with a coup as we thank Senator Susan Collins so
much. Thank you. Thank you very much.
That is an edited version of my conversation with U.S. Senator Susan Collins. You can hear our full conversation at gpbnews.org. From Georgia Public Broadcasting, this is On Second Thought. I'm Virginia Prescott. Now we add two more songs to our Georgia playlist. The rules, we ask artists to pick two songs written or performed by a Georgia artist, and they just can't pick their own. Amy Ray is part of the seminal folk group Indigo Girls. She's releasing her sixth solo album, Holler, on September 28th. And here are her essential Georgia tunes.
I'm Amy Ray from Indigo Girls from Atlanta, Georgia. And the first song for the Georgia playlist is I'm Gonna Sail Like a Ship on the Ocean by Henry Morrison and the St. Simon's Island Singers, captured by Alan Lomax.
I'm gonna sail like a ship on the ocean. I'm gonna sail like a ship on the ocean. I'm gonna sail like a ship on the ocean.
I listened to this whole collection. I bought it probably 15, 20 years ago, and basically played the whole thing. It's like four CDs, and it traces like Appalachian Mountains, the coast, kind of, and like blues kind of work songs.
My sailing day is over. I'm gonna sail till my sailing day is over.
He revealed what was going on in these out-of-the-way places, and he gave us a sense of empathy and compassion for other people, and people that ranged from, you know, white Appalachian rural mountain people to, you know, people that were living on the coast of Georgia, African-American communities, blues communities, old ladies in their kitchen singing songs about murder. I mean, he showed us something that you don't get to see just in the pop world of radio and now just like internet.
Well, I'm gonna sail till I sail up the glory. I'm gonna sail till I sail up in glory. I'm gonna sail till I sail up in glory.
The thing that field recordings did for me as a writer is it freed me up a little bit. And so, you know, with Indigo Girls, I had, you know, always written in a folk tradition and maybe influenced by punk rock a little bit. But to hear field recordings and the freedom of people that weren't necessarily schooled musically, but created a style that we try to emulate now, gave me a sense of freedom to, like, stretch a little bit. And I started writing songs that were in the tradition of, like, mountain music or field recordings, where I felt like I didn't have to follow a certain mechanism of verse chorus or a certain way of doing things. And also it freed me up, I think, production-wise, because the looseness of the call and response was not so rigid like the choral traditions that I had learned in. So I think it was a technical thing, but it was also just a spiritual thing.
My father.
The second song for the Georgia playlist is a song called Remains by the band Algiers. I discovered this band, I think it was like 3 years ago. It's led by a guy named Franklin James Fisher. Like the band itself struck me because they were mixing styles that were like kind of tied to this field recording thing, which went back to the gospel and field recordings of hand claps and call and response of the early Negro spirituals. But also he was mixing in like punk rock and like bands like Joy Division and bands that were more industrial. In the For me, they're a current representation of the Atlanta music scene because they're so cross-pollinated between black music and punk rock and industrial, kind of what was thought of, I think, in a way is like kind of like white punk industrial British music. To me, it's kind of part of the punk scene. Their energy is super young and very activist, almost like dystopian sort of cynicism, but at the same time, like energetic in this way that's just like, I don't know, like his voice has this really old fashioned quality, like almost like 1930s kind of a jazz vibe, but punk rock. And it's got a tone to it that's really interesting and not like anything I had heard. Georgia is vast, but the one thing about Georgia that threads everything together is that it's got an organic quality to it that is sweaty and down and dirty and risky, you know, and raw. And we've had to engage in dialogue in a very direct way for a really long time, and we haven't been polite about it. And so I think that's a beautiful thing to capture in music.
That is singer Amy Ray. Her new album, Holler, comes out this Friday.